why do you think Babaji came to America?
Well, Valerie, I think, I'm not positive, but in those days in India, it was the English that were ruling there, and they pretty much treated the Indians as slaves. That's what they did throughout the world, I guess. They have a history of that. And I'm assuming that my dad and my uncle decided to come here for a better opportunity and a new life.
When did they come? How?
They came in, actually, September of 1913 is where when they landed in San Francisco Bay for the second time, actually. The first time they came, they were turned back because they didn't have the $5 for the port fee. And so... Dad and my uncle Dal Singh came in 1913, actually September of 1913. And they came via the Manila and Shanghai. And they actually worked for the Shell Oil Company there in Shanghai as night watchmen. And so they worked their way over here. And actually there's a story about how they landed in San Francisco and they didn't have the $5 apiece to pay the port fee. And for $5, they turned them back. Now, $5 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it was back then. You got to think in 1913 dollars. But still, it's kind of sad. Just for $5, they got turned back. So they had to go back and work a few more months and then turn around and come back to, they came back to San Francisco and landed there. Then they worked their way down from San Francisco. And they lived in barns. Farmers would let them live in barns. And at first, they were a little bit hesitant to give them work because they looked so different. They had turbans on and they had the beard. So my dad used to tell me how, you know, at first it was kind of a little bit difficult to get work. But once the people got to know them, they were some of the best workers. And so, of course, they had work after that. And they finally worked their way down to Lone Star, which is south of here. And they stayed there for a while, working for a farmer there. And then they finally settled here in Clovis, bought this 40 acres that I grew up on, and they had some 20 acres in town and then another 20 just outside of town. So they were farming a little bit of land. That's what my dad did. Grandfather used to farm the Wona Ranch, several hundred acres, for an attorney in, actually the attorney I was told lived on 17 Mile Drive, and his name was Wilson. And my dad asked me to look him up, but I could never find Mr. Wilson because he wanted to talk to him and just reminisce and to see if he was still alive. But anyway, he farmed that, and he couldn't buy the land because of the Asian Exclusion Act. They would not let Asians buy property here in the United States in their name. So a lot of the Indians that came in those days married Mexican women or American women, mostly Mexican because they were very similar to Indian women as far as their cooking and stuff like that, and their culture was somewhat similar. So they would marry those women and they would buy the property in the women's name. Well, my dad and my uncle, Dal Singh, did not get married until after 1947, and that's when the Asian Exclusion Act was lifted. And so they had an opportunity to go back to India and get married. My uncle never did get married, but my dad, of course, in 1950 got married to my mom. And they came to this 40 acres that we're on right now and raised us. And it was a wonderful life when I was growing up. We had a very diversified...
Just how old was he when he got married?
He was 20 years old.
No. When he got married.
When he got married? Okay. My father was 55 years old when he got married to my mom, who was about 20. Okay, so because he had to wait so long, that's why it was kind of an unusual situation. So I remember growing up on the farm and my dad getting older and older, and being the oldest son, I had to fill in that space to work. I had to work very hard and work throughout the year because our crops would come in. We had different types of peaches and different types of plums, manageable plots so that we could work the land ourselves. We could do the pruning ourselves, and we could do the picking, and so that they the early peaches would come in and we'd take care of those, and then the mid peaches would come in, and then the late peaches would come in, the freestones, and the freestones we would cut and have a drying yard and actually dried peaches. And then later on, my mom started marketing, direct marketing peaches to the local markets, and that helped subsidize our regular farm income.
You grew up on this farm.
I grew up right here, and we built this house, of course, right on the corner of that 40 acres. I'm kind of sentimental. I was very hesitant about selling the property. I didn't want to do it. My brothers, though, of course, you know, it's just a smart economics, you know, to sell property when it's that high. And it was just not producing anything. And here we could sell the property for millions and had to be done. So, yeah, it was very sad. I did save the old house where I first, when I was born, we lived in for a year. So we have that still, and I'm going to incorporate. Yes, that the old house that I preserved, actually, when the developer came in, I told him I wanted to keep it. So he said, you move it, you can have it. So what we did is my brother and I put some logs underneath it, and I hooked onto it with my tractor and drug it over to actually my brother's lot next to us.
So why is it so there. Special?
It's very special because it was built probably around the turn of the century. And it's just a very old house, and some of the wood is even believed to have come from the very famous flume that came from the Sierra Nevada mountains here, came down into Clovis, right down where the rodeo grounds are now. So that flume was quite famous. The guys would ride the logs too down to Clovis from way up on that toll house grade. And so anyway, I lived in that house until I was 1 year old. So we moved into the second house where we lived on this property, and then we built a third house. So all three houses were existing at the same time. We just rented all the older house my uncle lived in until, you know, he got older. He died at the age of 94, and so did your grandfather. So
I want to back up because we were just at the Clovis Museum. And Peggy Boss, the curator there, I just said, my grandfather came here a long time ago. And without knowing anything about me, she says, you're Kahar's granddaughter. She knew everything about Babaji, and she went on about him. Oh, how did everyone know him? What did everyone think of him?
Well, you got a picture. Now, you know, you see a lot of people with turbans and beards. In those days, I was the only Indian at my high school, the entire high school. Well, other than my sister. So you can imagine my dad having a white beard, a really white beard, and wearing a turban. And so he was very distinctive, and people really liked him, and he knew everybody in town. And his best friend was John Antonio, who was the mayor for many years of Clovis. And so he had some very influential friends.
How did you get your name Judge?
Oh, gosh, yeah, that was funny. Actually, one of his friends was Judge Burke, and he was a very, very close friend of Dad's. And when I was born, instead of naming me Burke, he named me Judge, instead of Judge Burke. So anyway, that kind of stuck, and they always had aspirations for me to be a lawyer or a judge or something like that. So
So tell me more about how Babaji was really respected.
Yes, he was highly respected. In fact, I was very proud. He had this white Ford. He always had new pickups, trucks, you know. He had this white Ford, I remember, when I was growing up. And I would ride with him, and the kids would chase after a truck yelling, Santa Claus, Santa Claus. So I was just really proud, like, here's my dad, and everybody's yelling, you know, and thinking he's Santa Claus, and here I am riding with him. So that was quite fun in those days. Yeah.
Can I show a picture?
Actually, a picture of my dad. Yeah, this is when he was older. He's about 80. I would say about 86 at this time right here when this picture was taken. And
and that rock behind.
Yeah.
Can you tell the story.
Oh yeah. The rock here actually came from the New Mexico area, and it was picked up by my dad when he went to visit the Japanese that were interned in the internment camps in Arizona. So, some of his very good friends were Japanese immigrants, and he actually took care of some of the farms for Hiyamoto, took care of their farms while they were interned, and then the Takahashis were very good friends. In fact, Chuck he's my age or a little older than me, Chuck Takahashi's a great-grandson of the internment individuals, and he told me once that Dad was one of the few people that his grandfather would talk about that actually came and visited them in the internment camps in those days. So Dad was a very, you know, genuinely affectionate person. And in those days, everybody was very close. You know, they lived miles apart, but it was kind of very rural, and everybody knew everybody else, and it was just a real nice town to grow up in Clovis, yeah. So I've always loved this place, and that's why I haven't moved. But yeah, that's a petrified rock, as you can see. And it looks just like a piece of wood, and of course, over millions of years, the minerals replace the wood. So it's just not, the wood is not there anymore. It's just the impression.
Millions of years.
Yes, it takes a long time for that to happen. So,
did Babaji ever talk about experiencing any discrimination?
Well, as far as I can remember, he never mentioned anything about that. Everybody respected him and loved him, and people to this day that knew him speak very fondly of him. All the Indian people that I know talk about how remarkable he was. And I, you know, being his son, I didn't know that. I thought every dad's like that. But he had helped a lot of people from India to come here and study. He sponsored them and put them through college and all that. So he had a lot of friends. And there was one time that I remember. And this is when the Ayatollah Khomeini was in Iran and running the Iranian government at that time. And of course, we were the hostage situation and all that stuff happened. And so there was a lot of animosity against the Arabs in those days. And I remember pulling up to a stop sign and these kids in the car next to us. My dad was sitting in the car quietly, and they opened the window up and started yelling at my dad profanities and making lewd gestures and things like that. And it just broke my heart, because my dad was probably more American than those kids. In fact, when he became a citizen in 1972, he waited a long time to become a citizen. Of course, after 1947, he could have become a citizen any time. But in 1972, he felt that he needed to become a citizen. And from that date on, he, no matter what, if he was feeling bad or whatever the weather was or anything like that, he would vote. That was very important to him. So I remember taking him to the voting booths, and he would go in there and wouldn't tell me who he'd vote for, but he would vote. And that was very something that was very important to him. Yeah.
Why do you think Babaji chose for you? I mean, he kept his turban and beard all of his life. Why do you think he made the decision not to pass those articles down to his kids?
Well, yes, he was very, he kept his turban and beard. Unlike a lot of the Indians in those days, they assimilated and they shaved, but they married, American women. Dad kept that tradition because he went back and married an Indian woman, for one thing, and he always had that in mind, so he kept his turban and beard, possibly somewhat because of that. But he really believed in it. He believed in that. That was his religion from when he was growing up at a young age, and it just carried through the rest of his life. When we were growing up, since there weren't any other Indians here, and I just had American friends, they never really forced that on me. You know, we went to church, we went to the temple, twice a year, I guess, in Stockton. There was only two temples here, one in El Centro and one in Stockton. So that'd be like the big gathering of all the Punjabis twice a year at the birthday of Guru Nanak and Guru Gobind Singh. And so those are all holidays of our Punjab. So anyway, we would get together.
I mean, why do you think he never passed that on to you?
Well, I think he just didn't want to impose that on us. He knew it'd be difficult for us, being the only Indian. They weren't, you know, in school, and I would, it would be difficult, and he never did impose that on us. Yeah.
Did you experience anything? What was it like for you to grow up in Clovis as the only Indian kid Did people know who you were?
Yes, actually my friends were very interested because I was unusual. And all they knew about, in those days there was a cartoon called Johnny Quest. And that's what they knew about Indians. The little boy with a turban was riding an elephant and doing all these things, helping his name was Haji, and he was helping Johnny Quest, get the bad guys. And so, in fact, I even had a nickname at one time. They called me Haji, some of the guys, just for fun. But that was all they knew. So when they were interested in asking me questions, then I would take them to some Indian functions and like a khandpat and all that. And so they enjoyed that and they were very interested. I didn't see very much. I don't think I ever experienced any prejudice when I was growing up because I think because I was by myself, I wasn't in a group. I think maybe if there's a large group, like there are now, like in England and all that, I think it tends to create a little prejudice because they go, that's them and we're here. Being the only one, it was more of a unusual, these people are very unusual, we need to learn about them and that kind of thing, yeah.
So it's funny because our family... I just have one more question.
Actually, Dad had a very diverse group of friends, actually. There were some French immigrants here. Mr. Rooney was one of his very dear friends and actually taught him how to make wine. And so my uncle and my dad would make about 200 gallons of wine every year. My uncle actually drank more, and my dad had quit drinking once, we were growing up and he had quit. But my uncle drank the whole time, and he would use that 200 gallons up in a year. So every year they would make it. In fact, there's a story about that. Oh, wait a minute, let me go back to the immigrants. There were some Italian people. They got to be very good friends. In fact, Dad was they didn't trust anybody to bartend, and they trusted my dad. He was, they were telling me about how he would, make sure that, people stayed out of the booze and all that stuff. He's very trustworthy. And he had Italian friends. And there's some Italian people that come every year, and they would pick the grapes to take back to make wine. So it was very diverse. And Mr. Antonio was the mayor, as I mentioned earlier, was his best friend. And so there's
just there were Italians, yeah, there were French.
French, Portuguese settlers here. I mean, those were all, in those days, they were pretty new to California.
The Hague family.
The Hague family, yeah. My dad, Carl Haig's dad, was my dad's very dear friend and neighbor. And then when he passed away, Carl became a very good friend of my dad's. And then I got to be friends with his son, Mark Haig. And so we kind of grew up together. We were in grammar school, high school, went to college together, joined the same fraternity. And then we were business partners for almost 20 years. So, and he's still my best friend.
Can you tell me the Prohibition story?
Yes. Actually, as I mentioned, they were making this wine, and they made it for years and years. So during Prohibition, my dad would continue, and my uncle would continue to make wine, and the constable would come by. The constable was his friend, and they'd have drinks. So here's the constable, and they just left him alone because he wasn't selling it. He was just for his own consumption, and everybody kind of looked the other way in those days. But they would come over, the constable would come over and have wine with him. So that was kind of interesting. Yeah.
It's funny that our family has been here for almost 100 years, and yet there has been so much discrimination in the past few years. At our Gurdwara, do you remember last year when somebody graffitied, this is not your country?
Absolutely. I remember the picture.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Babaji, how do you think he would feel if he knew what was happening now?
Oh, I think he'd be heartbroken right now that people would think that way about, because he never experienced that, that people that would think that way about Punjabis in this new age. The old timers, it was a different age, and it was different. They're very genuinely friendly, and there was no prejudice at all.
He was proud to be an American.
He was proud to be American, yes. And in fact, after 1972, when he finally became a citizen, he felt the need to become a citizen of the United States. He always loved this country. And so in 72, when he became a citizen, he voted in the next election, and from there on, he never missed a opportunity to vote. And even when he got older, could barely walk, he would have me put him in the truck and we would go to the voting booth to vote. So he really took that privilege seriously. And
What do you think he would say about his granddaughter's project?
He would be very proud of you, Valerie. Very, very proud of you. Yes.
Oh, milking the
lamb. I actually wanted you to say what you said before.
Like what?
Because you were saying.
What about the director?
You were talking about skipped a generation.
Oh yeah, you should have. Mind, I could have said that.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
No, I was fishing for something else, guys.
Fishing.
Yeah, I don't remember. We were. Yeah, that was good. Yeah.